Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today, North Korea went public for the first time with its nuclear weapons, asserting officially what has long been assumed, the world's most secretive society and regime is also nuclear armed. In bringing their nukes out of the closet, the country's leaders also announced they were pulling out of anticipated multilateral disarmament talks with the U.S. Yet, for all the time, North Korea spends in the news because of nuclear brinkmanship as part of the axis of evil, it remains perhaps the world's least known, most closed nation. A new book by longtime Asia-based correspondent Bradley Martin looks deep inside North Korea. Tonight we'll hear what he's found. This hour, On Point, the unveiling of North Korea's nuclear threat and the driving motivation of the country behind the world's last Iron Curtain. You can join the conversation tonight. Has Washington's hard line on Pyongyang backfired? What does it mean that the real weapons of mass destruction are on the other side of the world from Baghdad? And what should the U.S. approach to North Korea be now? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin tonight in Seoul, South Korea, where leaders have expressed deep concern about North Korea's announcement that it is nuclear-armed. Joining me from Seoul is Gordon Fairclough, correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Gordon Fairclough, thanks for being with us.
Good evening, Tom.
So there's been so much talk about North Korean nukes for so long now. How was this announcement received next door today? As a shocker or as we knew that?
Well, I think the fact that they've got nuclear weapons was not a real shocker. The fact that they have decided to discontinue talks, however, I think is going to come to quite a surprise to people here this morning, where it is Friday morning and people are heading back to work after the Lunar New Year holiday. Officials here have been very optimistic that Pyongyang was finally about to come back to talks. And so the fact that they have walked away for an indefinite period, as they say, is certainly a concern here.
Remind us of what Washington and others were hoping for there, the so-called six-party talks. Who was to be involved, and what does it mean that the North Koreans are walking away?
Well, the six-party talks, Tom, have been going on in kind of fits and starts for nearly 2 years now, and this is the forum that has been put together to try to achieve some kind of a diplomatic solution and basically persuade the North Koreans that they should agree to dismantle all of their nuclear programs.
The six being China, Japan,
South Korea, Russia, the United States.
Mm-hmm. And North Korea, they hope.
And North Korea, of course, yes, mm-hmm. When they show up. And so the last round of these talks was held in June. The U.S. put a proposal on the table which laid out a series of steps that would lead to the rapid dismantlement of North Korea's nuclear weapons programs in exchange for energy assistance coming from some of North Korea's neighbors, as well as security guarantees, a pledge not to attack, which is something that North Korea has asked for.
And how is it being interpreted in South Korea that North Korea has taken this step now, that they've said, no way, we won't talk?
I think there's a lot of suspicion that it's continued kind of brinksmanship. It's a negotiating tactic. They're hoping to get something out of their interlocutors just for returning to the table. I think there's also some concern that there is in fact a kind of switch in North Korean strategic thinking now. They have taken this step for the first time officially in an official government statement this way of saying that they have nuclear weapons. Though this is a very interesting thing that North Korea has done here. They've been kind of backing with baby steps into becoming a declared nuclear power. As since spring of 2003, its diplomats, both in public and in private, have basically been threatening, saying that, in fact, they have nuclear weapons and the world should pay attention and this is a problem. But they have not, until this point, actually used the term nuclear weapons in this kind of official statement.
Doug, what's the range of views there so near to North Korea among South Koreans about the Bush administration's approach to Pyongyang, to North Korea? The White House has been pretty tough on North Korea under this administration. Is that seen as having paid off in Seoul or not?
I think generally sort of the public view here is probably that that more flexibility on the part of Washington would be a better move. The government here, however, has stayed pretty close to the U.S. line, though certainly South Korea as well as China have urged the U.S. Over the past year or so to be more flexible and to consider, you know, giving more concessions to the North to try to move things along here. The primary concern in South Korea, unlike in the United States, is that there will be some kind of a conflict or instability in the North, which would be hugely costly for people in the South, certainly if war were to break out. And they are less concerned about North Korea's nuclear weapons, which in any case they don't think would be used against them.
And what about the possibility of war? Of course, all those arms are very close to the capital of Seoul, where you are now. Does the South Korean government believe that behind the saber rattling, North Korea might be desperate or aggressive enough to actually go to war at some point?
I think, interestingly, Tom, most people in the United States are more concerned about an invasion by North Korea than people in South Korea. Relations between the two Koreas have warmed up quite considerably since a summit between the president here and Kim Jong-il in North Korea in June of 2000. And generally, I think the public view in South Korea is that while North Korea remains obviously a potential threat, that they would see conflict as highly unlikely.
But a big announcement today, and we can feel the tremors there. Gordon Fairclough in Seoul, thanks very much for joining us. Gordon Fairclough, correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Seoul, South Korea. For Washington's response to today's North Korean announcement, we turn to David Sanger, White House correspondent for The New York Times. He joins me now from Washington, where he has returned on Air Force One with the president today. David Sanger, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
The president cut short his stump tour for Social Security to come back to Washington, or at least it looked that way. Is it because of the North Korean announcement?
Yeah, he didn't. I don't think he cut it short at all. On days when he's doing the Social Security events, we have learned, as we have with campaign events, he likes to get home early.
He likes to sleep in his own bed at night.
That's right.
How rests the president's head tonight with this announcement from North Korea? What's the feeling around the White House? This can't look like a win for them, North Korea pulling out of these talks and making this bellicose announcement.
You know, it doesn't look like a win for them, but on the other hand, you know, when you step back and say, what has changed here? We have all known that North Korea has likely had nuclear weapons. You'll only know it for sure if they conduct a test, and they haven't gone that far yet. And I don't think there's any indication right now that they're doing that imminently. There was concern about that last year. In an odd way, this could play to the administration's advantage, or at least the advantage of some in the administration, particularly some of the hardliners, who have never liked these negotiations and who have always taken the position that they are sort of a waste of time, but a step that you had to go through in order to get to the next steps, which would be sanctions or some kind of more, you know, hardline approach to dealing with North Korea. And so to some degree, I think the North Koreans may have played into the hands of that faction of the administration. And as you and I have discussed before, the administration has long been very divided on how to go deal with the North. The other thing this does is it embarrasses the Chinese, who have been the middle-of-the-road players here and have always wanted to maintain the ambiguity that perhaps they didn't really have weapons.
And now that ambiguity is gone. What further sanctions are there that might be placed against North Korea?
We have imposed a lot of sanctions, but South Korea is, if anything, increasing its trade for the reasons that your last caller, your last interlocutor discussed. And, of course, China has always supported the North Koreans with oil and economic aid and at various moments has essentially bribed the country to come back to the table. And so the North runs the risk of angering the Chinese leadership enough that they decide to add to that squeeze.
So what's the interpretation at the White House, then, of why Pyongyang would make this announcement today, that they want to be...
That's an interesting question. Why do it now? And I've been talking to a few people in and outside of the administration now. And, you know, the main thing that's happened in the past 2 weeks is that the administration is obligation to Asia with new intelligence evidence on two different facts, or at least interpretations of the facts. The first is that the North has successfully completed the reprocessing of 8,000 spent nuclear fuel rods, probably enough to produce 6 or 8 new weapons. And the assessment that the CIA has come to is that work's probably done. It's also the same assessment that the IAEA, or the head of the IAEA, Mohammed Al-Baradei, gave to me in December. The second is that there's some evidence that the North was involved in the export of some half-processed uranium fuel to Libya. And this raised the possibility that for the first time we're seeing them actually begin to sell nuclear material. And that's worrisome. And both these issues would make things more uncomfortable for the North if they showed up in talks.
Is that fear of ongoing sale of nuclear material still alive, David Sanger?
Very much. Very much. And really, that's the big issue here. Because, you know, what are the chances that North Korea is going to launch an attack? Well, they could, but they know what the response would be, and it would be the end of their country. However, they could do a fair bit of damage to the proliferator.
Just by moving the materials. David Sanger at the White House, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
David Sanger, White House correspondent for the New York Times, who spoke with me from Washington. We are talking tonight about North Korea's unveiled nuclear threat and the driving motivations of the world's most secretive regime. You can join the conversation. Has Washington's hard line on Pyongyang backfired, or is it working? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about North Korea's unveiled nuclear threat and the country behind the world's last Iron Curtain. You can join the conversation tonight. What does it mean that the real WMD appear to be on the other side of the world from Baghdad? What should the American approach to North Korea be now? How do you understand the minds at work in North Korea? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. We'll hear a bit later in the program from Donald Grigg, former U.S. Ambassador to South Korea, chairman of the Korea Society. Right now I'm joined and delighted to be so from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, by Bradley Martin. He is author of the new book, Under the Loving Care of the Fatherly Leader, North Korea and the Kim Dynasty. He's professor of journalism at Louisiana State University. He's covered Asia for 25 years for the Baltimore Sun, the Asian Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, and more. Brad Martin, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you.
Great to be with you, Tom.
I'm sure you've watched today's news with particular interest, Brad Martin. How do you interpret this? North Korea saber rattles a lot, but this time they've made it official and public. They say, we've got nukes. Don't push us around. Why now?
Well, it was just a matter of time. I think the six-party talks were something that they didn't have sufficient control over. There were five parties, and then there was North Korea. So they have wanted all along to have a direct dialogue with the United States, and what they really wanted was for the United States to make them an offer that they couldn't refuse. And they are always thinking, how can we promote this? When do we need to bring out some new armament to promote the direct dialogue that we need.
Brad Martin, there's a treasure trove of detail, very hard to get, and you've delivered it in this new book, Under the Loving Care of the Fatherly Leader. We want to get into that. But let me ask you first. I know you've been thinking and writing lately that this may be the time for a real backflip in American foreign policy, that perhaps George W. Bush, like Richard Nixon to China, is the president, the conservative president, who could, who should, actually open to North Korea, say, let's change all this. You've said that the fundamental geopolitical and economic interests of North Korea are now reconcilable with those of the United States. Maybe George Bush ought to embrace them. Make your case.
Okay. Well, we start with the problem first. North Korea does have nuclear weapons, or so it says. And as David says, they could sell them. To whom might they sell them? Our worst enemy, Osama bin Laden. Mm. So we have to think, what can we do about that? War? Probably not. North Korea has a porcupine strategy. If we tried to take North Korea in war, it would be like taking Iwo Jima, but instead of being about the size of one ward of Boston, Iwo Jima would be the size of Pennsylvania if we tried to take the whole state of Pennsylvania as if it were Iwo Jima.
Because their defenses are so deep, so dense, so dug in.
That's correct. So forget about war, basically, and especially when we are occupied in Iraq, our stretch thin there. The North Koreans have already forced us to confront the fact that we are not up for wars on two fronts. And even if we were fully armed and had nothing else to concern us, it would still be hell to pay.
Not just for the American losses, but they would hit South Korea. They would probably hit Japan. And now they say they're nuclear armed. It could be just apocalyptic.
Yeah, well, they would probably first aim at Tokyo, I would think, or someplace in Japan.
So war's off the table. Still, how does that lead you to envisioning a George Bush handshake?
What's that? How does it lead? All right, well, we have to put the other off the table, too, the sanctions and threats. Those have not worked particularly well to shake up the North Koreans. They have not promoted either denuclearization or liberty or freedom or any of the other goals of the Bush administration.
And why not? Why hasn't that pressure worked?
Well, because the North Koreans are basically xenophobic and are trained to be xenophobic, to blame their problems mainly on enemies who threaten them and force them to spend most of their resources on the military to defend against those enemies.
And you don't mean just the leadership, but the entire population has this attitude. If we're in trouble, it's because
the population believes this. That is correct. They believe their main problem is us and the South Koreans and the Japanese.
So what might President Bush offer, and with what imagined effect do you see?
He really is going to have to offer something that is really going to sound very strange. He's going to have to offer actual friendship instead of enmity. He's going to have to offer to say, look, we don't need to be enemies any longer, and let's find ways that we can actually be friends. And this is going to be very, very difficult for Americans to swallow, but if anybody can persuade them to do it, it's Bush.
We've been in the posture of foes for so long. We'll get into their mentality. But on the American side, why is it that North Korea need no longer be seen as a foe, to your mind, Bradley Martin?
All right. Well, there's no global Cold War now. Kim Jong-il does not represent an ideology that's threatening to sweep the world and knock over domino countries here and there and defeat our Western values, our capitalist values, or whatever. In fact, he has basically given up on Marxism. His ideology has been changing rather quietly in the last few years. To actually embrace people who can make money for the society or for the regime. So we are not confronting the kind of implacable enemy that we are in the case of, say, Osama bin Laden. It's a far different level of enmity that's really based more on habit and on the fact that, of course, he has this horrible human rights record, which has brought him into increasing ill repute in Washington.
So you're saying kill them with kindness or embrace them with kindness. The other options are lousy. They've got nukes, and there's really not much to lose and maybe much to gain. Bradley Martin, you've delivered such a giant periscope into this country. I wish you'd give us a flavor. I hardly know where to jump in here. If Americans did make overtures to North Korea that led to somehow doors opening there, if Americans listening to us now could walk into North Korea tomorrow, what would they find? What would most jump out at them?
Are you talking about negatives or positives here, Tom?
Put it however you like it.
All right. I mean, it is a strange society. When I first went there in 1979, I found it incredibly bizarre because the people had been so deeply indoctrinated to worship their leader. But we would find it, people who went there now would find that gradually tapering off because the old leader is dead, the one that they really genuinely and truly loved. The new leader, there's a certain habitual quality to their reverence for the new leader. So the country's changing in this regard. It's changing drastically in terms of the old iron rice bowl mentality of all communists. When they thought the state will provide, the state failed to provide all through the 90s during the famine.
Millions died, we're told.
We are told, and that's probably correct. And the people responded by learning how to survive. The ones who survived learned how to survive, and this often involved trading, entrepreneurship, the sorts of behavior that that really had two sides to the coin here. On the one hand, it made them more congenial with capitalist values, but on the other hand, they've given up a lot in terms of their own collectivist morality, which was sort of a golden rule type of morality, do unto others or treat other people well and look out for the society as a whole. That's disappearing in North Korea, and in its place is, you know, I've got mine and I'm going to go out and do what I can. Capitalists of any stripe might find them easier to deal with now.
Sounds like a bit like China, though we know they're on a different page still. Nick Kristof calls your book the best book ever written about North Korea. I wish you'd give us some snapshots or anecdotes that illustrate some of these big themes, the tyranny, the human rights abuse, and maybe some of these sprouts of something new and different. Give us some glimpses, Brad Martin.
Well, you know the tyranny is horrible. Kim Il-sung, the founding ruler, he said factionalists, that is anybody who disagreed with him, would see three generations wiped out,
and that's i.e. their entire family, three generations of a family that opposed him.
So he not only sent off the offender to a prison camp, he sent the offender and his children and his children's children, and these people have basically rotted in these concentration camps. This family responsibility system is one of the most objectionable in the world. It's also very effective because anybody who even contemplates showing any rebellion against the regime thinks, oh my God, you know, my relatives are going to suffer.
But Kim Il-sung is gone. It's the son in his place, Kim Jong-il, not quite the same stature. Has that made room for dissent, or is there still today the same kind of fear and the same kind of three generations punishment?
You know, Kim Jong-il realizes that he doesn't have the same stature as his father. Kim Il-sung believed all the publicity about him, and a lot of that publicity was generated by his son, who had this remarkable ability as a propagandist. But Kim Jong-il knows that the people don't worship him as wholeheartedly as they did his father, and he knows that if he cracks down too hard, that the people might rise up and overthrow his dynasty. And so he seems to have decided late in the 1990s that he was going to go in the other direction. So he actually moderated some of these abuses and avoided a major crackdown at a time when a major crackdown might have led to the collapse of the regime.
But you describe him as still being capable of incredible kind of acts of what almost seem like random cruelty. You convey a story of one of his assistants who got drunk and told his wife about his boss's womanizing. This is an assistant of Kim Jong-il. Play that story out for us, Brad Martin.
Well, this is a story for which we have only one person who has told this story. That's the defector Hwang Jong-yop. Now, he's a respectable defector. He was a very high-ranking person in the regime, but he does not claim to have witnessed this personally.
Okay.
In any case, he says that a woman heard a man who worked for Kim Jong-il went home drunkenly, told his wife about the debauchery of Kim Jong-il, who has, you know, thousands of women at his disposal. And the woman was shocked because she believed in the traditional communist morality. Mm-hmm. So she wrote a letter to his father, who was still alive at the time. What she didn't know was that Kim Jong-il was the gatekeeper for all of his father's mail, so he naturally received it, and he called in the woman and ordered her shot, and then the man offered to do the job himself. Now, I'm not going to vouch for that story, but it is. There are a few other stories of sort of random cruelty. What you have to put against that is this, that Kim Jong-il is not a Hitler in the sense that he's not a genocidal maniac. He doesn't go after large groups of people and try to kill them off. Mm. So we have more tales of his sort of individual peccadilloes when he got upset with people than we have of anything on a vast scale. And on the vast scale, as I said, there are a few positive points where he has moderated the regime's policies. And this is one reason I think we might be able to make a deal with him, because I think he is open to considering human rights issues. He's open to outside persuasion on these issues. In the case of Europe, a number of European countries have established relations with North Korea in the last few years. And in the process, some of them complained about human rights abuses. And he made some responses here and there. There were a few small moderations in the way that his subjects are treated.
So reason to think about a different relationship, about a let's make a deal attitude at some level. Brad Martin, stand by. We've got callers who want to join this conversation. I want to turn to them. Steve is calling from Martin, Kentucky. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to make a few comments about the situation we're discussing here tonight, and mainly that Kim Jong-il, to me, seems to be a megalomaniacal person that I'm not sure there is any really correct approach on how to negotiate with such a person.
And yet we have to have some approach.
Yes, we do. And I think the six-party talks are probably one of the best ways to engage him as far as getting as many countries involved in the process as we can.
Because you think they can bring more pressure to bear from many different angles, Steve?
More pressure, and the more people we have working on this problem to try to keep eyes on things that are going on there and try to keep his nuclear capability or materials contained, you know, I would be more worried about him exporting it than using it. And I think one of the primary players that you don't hear mentioned very much, well, I haven't heard lately, is China. And to get them engaged more in the process and to be more aggressively engaged with North Korea, I believe they would have a greater influence on the country and their leaders than any country in the world.
Steve, let us pick that up. Brad Martin, how about it? We've heard just in the last couple of days the Bush administration sending emissaries out with letters to the leaders of China, South Korea, Japan, saying let's really work on this. Has China come through? Do they have conflicted interests here? They must not be happy with a nuclear-armed North Korea.
No, they aren't. But on the other hand, they don't want they don't want North Korea to collapse and become part of South Korea. South Korea actually, you know, after all, has American troops in it. Mm. So they have a certain interest in maintaining a separate regime there. And they have probably less control than they would like to have. They have certain leverage, but they do not have control over North Korea. So, but I agree with Steve that we need to keep all these people, all these countries involved and on point.
But in the end, is it their relationship with the United States that's going to make or break the situation?
That is correct, in my opinion.
And why? China's a big country. Japan's a huge economy. South Korea's right next door. Why the U.S. after all these years?
Well, bear in mind that we are still officially at war with North Korea. The Korean War did not end. There was only an armistice, a ceasefire in 1953. So for more than 50 years, although we stopped firing, we've still been at war.
Ceasefire, not a peace. Brad Martin, please stand by. Talking tonight with Bradley Martin, author of the great new book, Under the Loving Care of the Fatherly Leader, North Korea and the Kim Dynasty. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you understand the minds at work in North Korea now? How can the world challenge this hermetic nuclear power without risking war? And could it be time to kill or embrace North Korea with kindness? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about North Korea's unveiled nuclear threat and the driving motivations of the world's most secretive regime. You can join the conversation tonight. Should George W. Bush be to North Korea what Richard Nixon was to China, the conservative who reaches out to the old enemy? What is the answer to the Korean conundrum? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been speaking tonight with Bradley Martin, author of the book Under the Loving Care of the Fatherly Leader, North Korea and the Kim Dynasty, a terrific big survey. It goes deep on this most secretive of countries. He's joined us tonight from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We're joined right now from New York by Donald Gregg. He's chairman of the Korea Society, was ambassador to South Korea from 1989 to 1993, was national security advisor to then Vice President George H.W. Bush from 82 to 88. He was in the CIA in Asia for 25 years, moved to the National Security Council, where he was in charge of Asian intelligence and policy. Ambassador Gregg, thanks for being with us tonight.
Delighted to be with you.
So here we are at a moment without a lot of great options. Bradley Martin suggests that maybe it's time to turn the table over entirely and reach out to North Korea, that there's no fundamental strategic conflict of enough consequence to keep up this antagonism. What do you say, Ambassador?
Well, I think there's a good deal to that. I think I've been listening to blather all day on what the North Koreans have been saying, and most of them ignore the fact that at the end of their rather saber-rattling statement, they said our ultimate goal is the denuclearization of the entire Korean Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
So they are willing to give up their nuclear weapons at this point in return for a dialogue with the United States in which they feel they can have sufficient faith that we're not going to blow them out of the water.
But you know, many conservatives within the Bush administration have repeatedly said you cannot trust the North Koreans. Whatever they say, they're not going to give up these weapons. They can't be trusted. We can't do business with them. It's got to be a tough guy approach.
I don't know on what basis these people say that. I have been to North Korea three times. I have had more talk with the North Koreans than any of those people. I've been dealing with Koreans since the Korean War. The North Koreans are not that different from the South Koreans. They have an agenda. They feel hedged in by us. They have turned to nuclear weapons as a defense. They hear very harsh rhetoric from the Bush administration. I think they were hoping for a change in the second administration, and what they get is outposts of tyranny from Condoleezza Rice.
Right off the bat in the inaugural.
They don't like it. Mm-hmm. And they don't like it. And they don't like to be called names. I don't think anybody likes to be called names. And so they're raising the stakes. They're saying, look, we'll come back to the six-party talks, but we want to be treated with respect. What I think they really would like would be a raise in the level of dialogue. They got that twice under Bill Clinton. They got Jimmy Carter in 1994, who headed off a very drastic a conflict at that point by going and talking to Kim Il-sung. And they got it in 1998 when Bill Perry, the former Secretary of Defense, went north and did excellent work on missiles. And that triggered a visit to Washington of the second-ranking man in North Korea, a visit to Pyongyang by Madeleine Albright, and an almost visit to Pyongyang by Bill Clinton.
So you've been involved for many years. You know President Bush Sr. very well, worked closely with him, worked closely involved with the CIA. You were ambassador in South Korea. What do you think is the motivation of the current administration to want North Korea in such a rigid box? Why don't they show more flexibility?
I think it's a very moralistic, hardline approach. I think there's also the fact that North Korea has been, since 1998, the poster child for missile defense. I think there are some within the Bush administration who think, if not say, if we solve that problem, what's our justification for missile defense?
In other words, we want Star Wars, so we need the Korean threat to justify it.
That's part of it. And then we have a national tendency when we have an opponent who's looks a little eccentric, whom we don't understand, we tend to demonize them and fill our gaps of ignorance with prejudice. We did that with Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam, and I spent 4 years dealing with that. And we're doing the same thing with Kim Jong-il, and it's a very unfortunate tendency.
But, Ambassador Gregg, I have to ask you, is North Korea not an outpost of tyranny? Is that not a factual statement?
Yes, sure, it is. I'm not denying any of that. The question is, how do you get them to stop? How do you get them to change? You know, I think the Bush administration feels that regime change is the answer. And I would take us back to Iran, to Guatemala, to Chile, and now to Iraq. And you remove surgically a bad leader, and what follows? It isn't the ding-dong, the witch is dead approach where, you know, the witch is dead and everybody runs into the street and lives happily ever after. There are horrible forces unleashed that have been suppressed.
Yep.
And so I think you take a leader who is showing signs of wanting to change, as Kim Jong-il is, and you encourage that. And that's the way the Chinese, the Russians, and the South Koreans see him. And we are increasingly, I think, at odds with members of the six-party process. Japan is still hung up over North Korea. It's still unwilling to deal with some of the issues of its own history. So Japan is more or less with us. But the other nations would much prefer us to raise the level of dialogue and to sit down with the North Koreans and get them to join what is a tremendously encouraging process of coming together in a region of the world where countries have been at war for centuries.
Ambassador Gregg, Bradley Martin, please stand by. I want to welcome more callers into this conversation. Brett is calling from Eden, North Carolina. Brett, hi. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for taking a call.
Sure.
I'm really glad to be hearing what I'm hearing. I lived in South Korea near a small town called Anjung-ni for 4 years during the 80s. I was over there during the Olympics.
You were in the U.S. military?
Yeah, I was in the Naval Security Group. And
okay.
I was doing work that was all about North Korea, and that's about as much as I'd like to say about that.
Okay.
But I'm really glad that the dialogue is beginning to talk about culture and context, because when I lived over there, I had the benefit of the language at my disposal. And I'm a musician, and I found myself seeking out culture, as you know, like the actual arts and stuff.
And are you saying that as you used your linguistic ability and your time there to look into North Korea, you saw a country that you think could be won over with kindness rather than saber rattling on the U.S. side?
Oh, absolutely, because you know, to really understand how to deal with that country and its leadership, which are really as one, you have to realize that they've been around for a very long time, and they do things very deliberately and have done that for a very long time. And, you know, the results are mixed, but there's a lot of pride involved here, cultural pride, and because of the investiture of effort in what's been going on.
For so many years, but you were there, frontline, U.S. military, and you say, let's give it a chance. Brett, thanks for your call. Brett Martin, what about all this talk of peace and love is nice, but it's a nuclear weapon or weapons that have been announced today. What about the North Korean military? Presumably, they're the ones who handle these weapons. Where are they? And is the military open to this kind of overture? After all, they have a lot at stake here if the current order goes away or changes dramatically.
Well, that's one reason we have to get to a very high level of dialogue, because they're certainly not subordinate to these civilians who have been doing the negotiations in the six-party talk.
The military is not. In other words, they're making their own rules.
They're only subordinate to Kim Jong-il.
I see.
He is the only civilian who has any say over them at all. They are the number one power in the country. This is close to a military dictatorship. In fact, you could call it a military dictatorship.
So is that dictatorship, is the military side of it open to the kind of changed relationship with the U.S. that you describe as possible?
I suspect it is. The military increasingly is. I talked to you about entrepreneurship and training.
Mm-hmm.
The pioneers in all of this have been military people.
Like in China, where they took over the alcohol business and others, they got
That's
into business.
Right. So it's the military that is in the vanguard of what we would call a movement toward capitalist style society. So these people, at least at high levels, would understand. Now, the lower-level military men, it is true, are more isolated from social trends than civilians. And so their fighting morale is probably higher than that of civilians at this point, and they probably are more deeply indoctrinated. So I'm not talking about the rank and file. I'm talking about the high-ranking military people.
Mm. Ambassador Gregg, we're talking here about potential opportunities, but it is on a day when North Korea has announced nuclear weapons. Do you see, you worked with President Bush's father, do you see in the Sun the potential for a Richard Nixon-style turn here? Nixon did it with China. Could George W. Bush, do you see in him the stuff to do that with North Korea? And if it's not done, what are we left with?
Well, I would hope that something like that would be considered. I'd like to give a huge plug to Brad Martin's book. It's very good to have 800 pages out there, which is not a polemic, but which is really a good introduction to a country. I wish that something like Nixon and Kissinger in China in 72 would take place, because they did not wink at the horrors that Mao had inflicted on his own people. But they recognized the fact that he was afraid of the Soviet Union, and this is a chance to break those two countries apart, and that has opened up a fabulous new chapter in Asia. I think the same kind of thing could happen toward North Korea, but we have, in a way, demonized Kim Jong-il, and I think it's very difficult for President Bush to go back on some of the things that he has said. I would hope that perhaps he could send somebody else with a high-level message to the North Koreans saying we want to start a new chapter, and I think if he did that, he would find a very positive response.
Well, big things in the air from North Korea, maybe big possibilities, but a question mark about what might be taken advantage of. Ambassador Donald Gregg, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Bradley Martin, author of Under the Loving Care of the Fatherly Leader, North Korea and the Kim Dynasty. Terrific talking with you, Brad. Thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Great to talk with you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, real life million-dollar babies. This is On Point. Clint Eastwood's Million Dollar Baby continues to rake in awards and box office millions. The film, about a scrappy female boxer and her curmudgeonly trainer, has shown a spotlight on the obscure world of female boxing. Joyce Carol Oates once wrote of the female boxer that she is parody, she is cartoon, she is monstrous. But that is not what writer Leah Hager-Cohen found when she followed the lives of four teenage girl pugilists at the Somerville Boxing Club near Boston. The girls she tracked came from poor neighborhoods. Some of them had gotten into street fights and bad behavior. The boxing ring became an outlet for their aggression and a crucial piece of their emotional development. To Cohen's surprise, she herself couldn't resist the lure of the ring. She began to train and spar with the girls. Cohen captures her experience in her new book, Without Apology, Girls, Women, and the Desire to Fight. Tonight, she reads a passage from the book and reflects on what drew her to the boxing ring.
Unlike the girls that I wrote about, I didn't grow up feeling like aggression was a part of who I was. And so here I was in my 30s coming to the boxing gym, and I was taken by surprise when I realized that I had aggression in me too. I was jealous of the girls when I saw them in the ring, and I developed this hunger that I had not imagined I could have to see what boxing would feel like for myself. Like the girls, I was able to use that aggression in a context that made it healthy for me, and it was positive. So I feel like the girls and I were coming from opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of how we related to our own aggression before boxing. We were similar in that through the experience of boxing, we were all able to find ways that we could use that aggression for the better. When I began to box, I was afforded a space in which to own my desire to be strong, and that was something I hadn't felt entitled to. I hadn't even considered that I could declare such a desire in the past as a woman. So ultimately, the girls that I followed and their coach taught me so much about what it is to be a woman. I feel that the person I was before I encountered the boxing gym, you know, was a fraction of who I am today. I'm going to read from the opening of the book where I describe my very first visit to the Somerville Boxing Club. My first impulse was to dismiss her. Whatever my idea of how a boxing coach should look, it was nothing like this woman standing above me on the ring apron, elbows on the ropes, calling out to her boxer in the ring. She wore a pink tank top, red shorts, white socks, and black boxing shoes, and her hair, wavy and fine and light brown, was held back with a pink scrunchie, and her limbs looked tender and ungainly and very white. She was little, Rafaela Johnson, 5'4" and not much over 100 pounds. But it wasn't just her physical size, it was her voice, too, a girl's voice, indelibly gentle and light. "You're dropping your hands," she yelled. "Jab, keep firing the jab. Work." In the ring, a teenage Latina girl was sparring with a white man in his 30s. The girl wore red headgear and gloves and a thick white mouth guard that made it look as if she couldn't suppress a smile. Her tank top said, "Don't even, don't even, don't even, don't even, don't even, don't even think about it." Her sparring partner, broadly muscular, wore black headgear and gloves. His bare torso was a gallery of sweat-glazed tattoos, the most magnificent of which, an American flag in the shape of the United States, with portraits of a woman and three children set inside the borders, rippled across his trapezius muscles and caught the light as he danced. Whenever the girl seemed to tire, the man would yell at her, provoke her, hit her in the face. "Come on, move," yelled the coach. 30 seconds. Clustered around her on the ring apron, variously standing or kneeling, were three other girls and a woman, all drinking in the spectacle with unchecked merriment, erupting in bursts of excited laughter, hoots of encouragement, and sharp exhortations that echoed those of the coach. Their obvious pleasure in the event seemed to me incongruous and complicated, but no more so than the sheer physical presence of the coach, to whom my gaze kept returning, even as the action in the ring commanded my attention. She was 32, I would later learn, but she looked half that. She was so small, that was the thing. She was the size of me.
Leah Hager-Cohen reading from her new book, Without Apology, Girls, Women, and the Desire to Fight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.